So, just to say, last year, I was really grateful to be able to spend a couple of weeks on retreat with the German monk and scholar Bhikkhu Anālyo, who I love. He's a really fun teacher. He's also very wise. And he's also very popular right now in the Buddhist community, mainly because of the books he's been writing, which are pretty dense with translations and comparative studies of Buddhist texts. And yet what I remember most from these books is just one simple phrase, and it basically sums up the entire practice of meditation in four words. Are you ready? You can go home after this. This is the whole talk. It's keep calmly knowing change. Keep calmly knowing change. And so I love that phrase so much, actually, that last year, one of my regular students in my Sangha made me a mug. She's a potter that had keep calmly knowing change. And then another student made me some bumper stickers. So if you see that in the parking lot, that's on my car. So I get to see it every day. And, you know, happily I get to review that message, teaching every single day. But also last year, I was up in Massachusetts for another two-week retreat, a private retreat, up at the Forest Refuge Center, and I didn't get to take my mug with me, so I'm going to blame it on not having my mug, but I found myself completely and utterly resisting change, really bad. And at the time, there seemed to be so much change on so many levels, change in my personal life, and of course, on a more national level, big change. And so this meant that I was also experiencing a fair amount of fear and uncertainty, because when we resist change, you know, we also tend to experience a corresponding amount of fear, since the two are intimately linked. So just as a for instance, right before I left for retreat, our landlords informed us, my husband and I, that while we were gone, they were going to have to have someone renovate our old, dilapidated, but very much beloved porch. And this meant that this giant 8-year-old wisteria plant that I'd planted and trained around, of course, the dilapidated, rotting windows of this porch was going to be torn down. And all the porch furniture and plants and chimes and books, everything was going to have to be stored somewhere inside our tiny cottage. We live on a 1,400-acre cattle farm, but we live in the old farmer's house, so we don't have to work on the farm or anything, but we get to enjoy this house. And unfortunately, it doesn't have a dry basement, so all of this stuff had to go into this tiny cottage. The family that had lived in our driveway, shared the driveway with us for 8 years, was going to move, so we were going to have new neighbors when I came back. And they were kind of surrounded by trees, and many of them are ash. So sadly, they also said, guess what, 40 of your trees that you look out on are going to be cut down. It's going to be a gigantic mess, because you know what happens when they cut the trees down. It's very messy. And so I was losing that landscape. So it was a big change at my home, sort of my place of refuge, my quiet refuge. And I had absolutely no control over it, so it felt like a lot of chaos. And perhaps as many of you, I still haven't quite wrapped my head around all the very big changes that are actually still occurring right now in our country, both politically and environmentally. You know, it's kind of hard to take sometimes. It's like hard to absorb it all, because it's just so much change all at once, all the time, every minute, it seems lately. And it does feel a bit chaotic and unsettling, almost like the rug has been pulled completely out, or on some days, like the rug is just being ripped into little shreds. It feels like that sometimes. Anybody else feeling this way? Show of hands. Okay. So I thought tonight that I would talk about finding peace in the chaos is the topic of my talk tonight. And how do we find balance in what seems like sometimes a tsunami of change? And I find it really helpful to remember that, according to the teachings, change is one of, if not the, main sources of our stress and suffering. Change. This is true even if you consider change sometimes to be a good thing, if you check it out. So just for a minute, think about when there's a good change in your life, like maybe a marriage or a baby or a job change or a move. These seem like really exciting, good, happy things. And they also cause a lot of stress. It's called eustress, actually, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, when it's a happy thing that causes stress. And the reason for this is because all of those things that I just mentioned involve change and not a small amount of fear, right? Think about when you had your first child, some of you, or when you got married or moved. It all involves a little bit of fear. So if we really start to investigate and are honest with ourselves, we might notice that we tend to want most things to remain the same because in some way it makes us feel safe or comfortable. It's friendly. It's familiar. And you might recall that the word familiar is related to the words family, friendly, which points to this idea that when we think we know something, when we think we know something, it becomes much less scary, much less frightening, okay? We tend to not like what is new and different, strange. New is a stranger, and we fear it sometimes, a lot of the time. And yet, the truth is always right smack in front of us. As the poet Robert Frost once wrote, in two words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It changes, right? So while I was on retreat, maybe because I didn't have my mug that my student made for me, I actually changed Bhikkhu Anayu's phrase a bit and started to use my own mantra prayer affirmation, which is, may I calmly welcome change. May I calmly welcome change. Now, I want to say this didn't mean I was approving of all the many things that were changing in my life and in the world. I was simply inviting myself to welcome the reality of change, the truth and inevitability of change, okay? To bring up yet another phrase that I was in a way honoring is a familiar phrase from the Zen tradition, which is three words. I say it often. This is it. So simple. It's such a good phrase to put on a sticky note somewhere to remind yourself, this is it. Which then inevitably also includes another phrase, which is now what? Right? This is it, now what? What is the wisest, most compassionate action right now? What is going to help me to keep my heart open? And what's going to be the most helpful for myself or others here? Now what? The problem, of course, is that we tend to resist the this is it, sometimes fiercely. And yet the truth is whenever we resist what is, when we argue with reality by running away or fighting like hell, blaming, trying to ignore it, just numb it out, we're in essence hardening our hearts by locking in whatever emotion that we're not allowing us ourselves to feel, okay? That's what happens when we resist change. So while I was on a retreat, I thought the word welcome would really help me to practice with this. It might soften my heart and also really help me to let go of my resistance. And part of this is because another truth is we really don't know. We really never can know what's going to happen next or what can change when we courageously open up to or welcome change, right? So as the writer John O'Donohue so wisely writes, in parched terrains, new wells are to be discovered. In parched terrains, new wells are to be discovered. Or as Theodore Rothke tells us, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. So every day while I was on that retreat, the morning wake-up bell would ring at 5:30 in the morning, and I would start my practice with my very first breath, waking up, and I would repeat my mantra to myself, I welcome change. I welcome change. And for the rest of the day, I would use this with everything I saw. So in the beginning, as with everything with practice, I started with something relatively easy. and is a way to build. It was a way to build or strengthen my mindfulness muscles, or maybe my letting go skills. So at first, I started paying attention to the weather. That was easy. So I remember, for instance, walking outside on this particular sidewalk every day, and each hour noticing how different it was. We had to do walking meditation, you know, all day. We were sitting or walking meditation, going on the same path. So each afternoon I would notice, in the morning it was rain, and then a couple hours later there was ice, and then in the afternoon there was snow, and then there was snow melting. So I kept watching that change and noticing even more little details, like the little sticks or branches or the leaves that had gathered there, and how they'd moved or shifted with the snow or the ice, how they'd gotten frozen in the ice. I just watched that. And each time I saw that, anything, I welcome change. I welcome change. And after a while, when that mantra started really settling into me, I started using it more and more for my thoughts and my fears. So whenever I thought about my beautiful wisteria bush being cut down and what it was going to look like when I came back, or my new neighbors, or the new administration, I would say, I welcome change. I welcome change. And as you might imagine, this wasn't easy, right? The weather was easier, I get that. So what I first experienced was a gigantic no, hell no. You know, I do not welcome this change at all. And I definitely don't feel calm about it either. I was often frantically trying to resist it. I also noticed at the same time that I had a gigantic, serious, toxic case of what I call the shoulds. He shouldn't, I shouldn't, they shouldn't, you know, this shouldn't be this way, that shouldn't be. I was, as I often say, shoulding all over myself. Which is really unpleasant. And each time I noticed that I in some way should it on myself, I also noticed how everything had gotten just very tight and closed off and constricted, my mind, my body, my heart, because I was saying, no, I don't welcome this. I don't welcome this. But I noticed it. And as the retreat continued, this noticing really helped me to start to wake up to the pain of my resistance. And as I did, I made an even stronger, more conscious effort to be mindful of change and to welcome change. And this meant to make an effort in the practice to calmly, compassionately welcome all of it, to open up to everything, including my resistance, including my fears, my sadness, my grief, to let it all flow through without fighting it so much and without judging it. Eventually, this did help me to open and soften a little and truly become more calm and accepting of, okay, this really is it. This is it. Now what? Okay. And as I said, this isn't easy, which is why it's called a practice and something we continually ask ourselves to do. So as Bhikkhu Anayu suggests, that we keep calmly knowing change. He didn't suggest maybe every once in a while, when it's convenient, you might happen to notice that things have changed a little bit, right? He asks us through our practice to make this a continual remembering of change. This is such an important teaching, actually, because as we've all experienced, whenever we're surprised or maybe hit by strong change, maybe punched in the gut all the way down to the floor with change, it's often extremely difficult to discover our balance again, or to discover that sense of calm, or even sometimes to find our hearts again. And yet, as the teachings show us, it's incredibly important that we continue to try, right? To keep calmly knowing and even welcoming change. Instead of letting the constant flow of change kind of sweep us out and under, away from our wise, compassionate, good, awake hearts. Teacher Jack Kornfeld tells us, at times we cannot feel love, because of our confusion and the pain we carry, because of the suffering around us, our love is buried. In spite of this history, we must learn to find love again in our body and heart, in our community, in all things. The great musician Leonard Cohen, who just left us recently, once said, "If you do not become the ocean, you will be seasick every day." Just love that. If you do not become the ocean, you will be seasick every day. So about 25 years ago, I was originally trained in practice at Naropa University. And this is a Tibetan Shambhala university founded by Pema Chodron's teacher, Trogyam Trungpa. That's where I started, in the Shambhala tradition. And in this tradition, there are a list of slogans that we're asked to memorize as a way of training the mind. And these are called the Lojongs. I think slogan, Lojong. And lately, I've been thinking of two of these as the regard working with change and finding peace in the chaos. So I'm going to offer these to you tonight. They are always maintain only a joyful mind, which is worded kind of oddly, I think, but always maintain only a joyful mind. And this other one is, if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained. If you can practice even while distracted, you are well trained. So they sound different, but they actually go hand in hand because they essentially mean the same thing. So the first one, always maintain only a joyful mind, means that if you can regard everything that arises, no matter what it is, as fuel to wake you up, you can remain cheerful. Use it as fuel. So this one always makes me think of, the Buddha was called the happy one. I love that. People always think that Buddhism is so grim because it focuses on suffering, but the Buddha was actually called the happy one. And when I think of that, it reminds me also of the Dalai Lama, who's become kind of a living example of the Buddha. And in his fierce commitment to joy and compassion, even in the face of great sorrow, the ripping apart of his home country and his lifelong expulsion from it, he still remains joyful. It also relates to a phrase I'm sure most of you have heard from Tara, which is one of my favorites, and I say it often, which is, may this suffering serve awakening. May this suffering serve awakening. It's that sense of, I bow to it. Thank you. I welcome this challenge, the suffering, because I know that if I can stay with it, open my heart and welcome the pain and discomfort of it, the grief, the anger, whatever it is, this is going to transform me. Maybe even transform others around me, right? If I can stay with it and welcome it and open to it rather than resist. So the intention always, for me anyway, in this practice is always and forever, please may this difficulty open my heart and soften it rather than harden it. Whenever there's difficulty, let this soften my heart. Let me open to it, because I don't want my heart to get hard. The second Lojong is, if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained, is similar in that it's asking us to use everything in our lives to wake ourselves up rather than to put us to sleep. So what this Lojong is saying is that we can actually use the distraction or the change or the disappointment, the pain or the fear to awaken us to the present moment. And sometimes it's related to how a horse rights itself after losing its balance, comes back. So being well-trained means you catch yourself, your horse, the mind, if you will, when it starts falling over that cliff, and you consciously come back to the present moment, consciously come back to the feeling of the sun, you know, the smells, maybe the autumn leaves, the colors, the breeze, this moment, right now, come back. We come back and find balance. The teacher Sharon Salzberg reminds us, in times of great struggle, when there is nothing else to rely on and nowhere else to go, it is the return to the moment that is the act of faith. From that point, openness to possibility, strength, patience, and courage can arise. Moment by moment, we can find our way through. Moment by moment, we can find our way through. So just as an example of that, again, when I was on retreat in Massachusetts, we were visited again by a lot of snow and ice, which meant that navigating my walks around these icy roads became very interesting and challenging. And one of our teachers, Caroline Jones, pointed out that our practice is a lot like balancing on the ice and snow. And what happens is that when we're walking on the ice and snow, we're extremely mindful of the present moment. We're very gentle with ourselves, and we're patient. We don't go fast. And we all intuitively know how to find or reestablish our balance, but the trick is to pay attention, right? The trick is to pay attention so we can use our practice like we're walking on snow or ice. So this idea of practicing while distracted also means that we can use the distraction, the chaos, the suffering, whatever it is, the ice, if you will, to train and bring in compassion to ourselves and then to all the others who are struggling with the same thing. So as we keep our heart open to what's here, what we discover is that sense of, I am not alone, which also helps to comfort what is considered our deepest source of suffering, which is a sense of being separate. So we get in touch with, I am not alone. So just another example of that, when I was walking down one of the paths up at the retreat center, down this very long, extremely icy, dirty road, like really one of those, it was sheer, almost sheer ice, just a little tiny bit of gravel in there to help. And I was walking tiny, tiny, tiny steps, a little afraid, wondering if I should have taken another route instead of that one. And I saw in the distance up ahead a fellow yogini walking towards me, also taking tiny, tiny steps. We were talking, taking tiny steps towards one another. And I suddenly felt not only not alone, but just a great caring for the woman walking towards me. I really wanted to make sure she was safe, you know, kind of looking at her as I was trying to concentrate, like, I hope she doesn't fall. And in our silence as we passed, you know, we're not supposed to make eye contact, actually, when we're on silent retreat, but we did, because I think we were both trying to say, I hope you're okay, you know. And it was interesting to know that, in the same sense, we're both walking this slippery, precarious, beautiful, icy path, and that we're not alone in our struggle or our fear. And life is that, isn't it? Life is that icy, slippery, precarious path. It can be. Especially in this moment in our history, I think so much of the suffering we're experiencing is just this. It's our sense of divisiveness, being other than, separated from one another. You know, so when we can make an effort to connect with all of those who are suffering, all of those who are feeling fear, you know, maybe in different separate ways, it can help us actually to feel more calm and more expansive, because it's going to open our hearts to a sense of connection. So the Lojan, always maintain, always a joyful mind, means to remember your level of suffering always depends on how you're relating to whatever's happening, even when you can't change the situation. This is always true. As Tara once so wisely wrote, our attitude in the face of life's challenges determines our suffering or our freedom. Isn't that true? It's so simple, but it's so always true. So in essence, both of these lojans are pointing to what is considered the fruit of the practice, which is equanimity practice. And in the Pali language, there are several words for equanimity used by the Buddha. Most common of these is upekkha, and its root meaning is to look over, to look over. And this refers to the equanimity that arises from the power of observation, which means it's pointing to our ability to see without being caught by what we see, without getting hooked. And this is where our daily practice on the cushion comes into play. So it allows us to be aware of what's happening and the thoughts, then emotions that are arising, without necessarily believing our thoughts as true or acting upon them. We can simply rest We can practice resting in awareness itself, awareness of whatever's happening. And that resting place is calm. It's not affected by the swirl of whatever's happening. It really is that, you know, equanimity is finding that calm in the middle of the storm. In India, the word upeka was also sometimes used to mean to see with patience, to see with patience. And here I like to remember something theologian Howard Thurman once said, which I love. He said, we need to practice looking at the world with quiet eyes. I just love that metaphor, which also points to the calm aspect of Bhikkhu Nalyo's suggestion to keep calmly knowing change. Keep calmly knowing change. So traditionally, many of you may know Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is often shown holding a vase representing the cooling water of Pasadi, tranquility, calm for the mind. So whenever we're experiencing a sense of chaos or worry or fear or even anger about something, it's almost like there's a fire in the mind, isn't there? If you check it out, really check it out next time you're angry about something or worried or fearful. Look into it. It can feel like a fire in the mind. And so the basadi, the calming aspect, is the cooling aspect, chilling out. We even use it in our language, right? Cool out, chill out, cool down, keep your cool. And this is something that we're actively cultivating when we meditate. Many of you even might have gotten a sense or taste of that just in that half an hour, you know, that calming aspect that we're cultivating. So the teachings tell us that in order to cultivate basadi, what we really want to do is work on practicing three things, okay, which is calmness, spaciousness, and groundedness. Calmness, spaciousness, and groundedness. So we start with the calming aspect of the practice. So the first thing we can do is recognize when we're stressed in some way, or we're having a strong emotion, or we're worried, or we're in fear. And we can then literally stop whatever we're doing, take a few nice deep breaths all the way down into the belly, which, by the way, is very calming. If you're really upset, sometimes go right to the belly. A lot of people go right here, which is fine to calm the heart, but you might put a hand on the heart and the belly, because the belly is really where the emotions are. So we drop down, and we let everything drop. So we breathe, drop the shoulders, unclench the jaw and the fist, the hands. We relax the eyes and the forehead. We let the tummy be soft, and we really fall down and sense our feet and our body being grounded. That's the calming part. In formal practice, when we're trying to calm the mind and the body, we might even choose to place all of our attention and focus on the breath. Concentration practice is also really calming, okay? So that spaciousness, we start with the calming, we start with concentration. If we can focus on the breath, it's going to slow down our busy minds. It's going to help us to let go of all the thoughts that are keeping us, taking us away, keeping us from being present. And it's going to help us to let go of all the commentary and the narrative that is pouring fuel onto that fire in the mind. Okay? It's that old idea of by calming the breath, we calm the body. And by calming the body, we calm the mind. They're all connected. As we continue to calm the body, we can then focus on a sense of spaciousness. And we might start by imagining letting go of what we consider our limited self, our small spacesuit idea of a body, and imagine our field of space extending out beyond the body as wide as our energy needs, maybe the whole cosmos. And that's what I was trying to get at as we meditated today in the guided. You become kind of, you focus on the breath, go through the breath, and then you open up, you become fluid, okay? Open up to space and let go of body, opening up. When we do this, when we open up, it can again help us to remember that we are not alone. We're not separate, okay? We can open up to everybody else in the room, the whole cosmos. We are not alone. We're connected. And we're so much bigger than our temporary, ephemeral thoughts and emotions. We are that big, loving field of awareness. That's really who we are. Tara talks about that, I know. And finally, there's groundedness, okay? So we can remember to sense into our innate connection to the earth and remind ourselves that we are earth. We are made of earth, air, fire, sun, water, stars. So it's really helpful. On Monday, I'm giving a guided walking meditation out in nature. It's mindfulness in nature. And it's really simply all about reconnecting to the earth and feeling the earth elements in your body and getting really grounded. And we can do this every day, all the time. We can do it in our practice. It's part of the Satipatthana Sutra instructions, actually, to get in touch with the earth, air, water, fire, all the elements in your body. So an easy way to do this is to feel your sit bones. Feel them right now. Feel your sit bones and the weight of your skeleton, right? Can imagine your skeleton. Feel your feet on the earth. Whenever you're in a conversation with somebody and you're standing, that's one of your touch points. Go right to your feet. It's going to ground you. So feel your feet and your sit bones, skeleton, earth element. It's grounding. And you can even imagine yourself, especially through the feet, just like I offered in meditation, sense not only your connection, your rootedness, but sense energy coming up from the earth. Use that energy to bring you energy. Okay? Sense, start sensing into that. When you're breathing, sense wind. When you feel heat, sense sun. When you feel that fluidity, think ocean, you know. And again, these practices are a way to help us to not feel so alone and remember that we are intimately connected to the earth, to all beings, everything. Okay. And to discover calm, we actually need to practice calm, to incline the mind towards calm. Okay. And we're also inclining the mind towards things like kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, the four divine abodes, those heart and mind states where we want to dwell. The Buddha told us that which we give our attention, the mind inclines. Okay. As the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us, when we are feeding our fear or anger or negative thoughts, we are in essence practicing fear, anger, negativity. It's like our minds are becoming fat with these negative emotions. We're fattening, we're feeding them with anger. Instead, as Thich Nhat Hanh urges us in his famous book, Being Peace, we need to constantly remember to practice being peace. Practice being peace. It's like a phrase I once heard from a Buddhist activist group in New York City, which is, don't go to a peace rally angry. Or Pema Chodron once asked, wait a minute, is there something wrong with this picture? Clobbering people with your peace sign? That's a funny image. So it can also, you know, along the same lines, we can start to become aware of what we're putting into our minds. What are we feeding our minds and therefore our bodies and our hearts? So, for example, you might ask yourself, consider, how much negativity am I feeding my mind? Really, truly think about it. How much stimulus or negative caffeine, if you will, have I been drinking? Is the radio always on? NPR, maybe, or TV? How many articles am I reading online? Maybe about the same thing, right? Am I constantly talking about, chewing on, discussing negative things? And you might notice, how much am I talking instead of feeling? That's a good question to ask yourself. How much am I reading, digesting, feeding instead of feeling? You might even ask, may I be addicted to a sense of outrage? Am I addicted to outrage? How much noise is there around me? How much activity? And we might even ask, how much of the stimulus am I creating myself? Because we can do that too. And as we practice this inquiry with great kindness, we can remember that instead of negativity, we might try feeding ourselves with a little more gratitude, right? The mind can actually not hold two thoughts at the same time. So if you see a negative thought, see if you can notice it and what it's, how it's affecting your body, and see if you can turn around. What can I be grateful for? Just try it this week. What can I be grateful for? Feed the mind gratitude. Feed the mind kindness. How does that feel in the mind heart when you do that? Besides metta, loving kindness, gratitude is actually considered one of the main antidotes. It's like a pill. It's the main antidotes to worry and fear. And it can really help us to more calmly welcome change. Okay. It can also be helpful to recall or remember to feed our deep intention, to awaken and to evolve, because our awakening is honestly going to help the world to be a better place. Our own awakening is going to help the world to be a better place. Just this month, I was struck by something the author and professor Robert Reich offered us as a way of encouragement in one of his talks. He said, "You are the leader you have been waiting for. You are the leader that you've been waiting for. Especially right now, truly you are needed. Your practice is needed. Your calmness, your equanimity, joy, wisdom, kindness, it's all needed." So as encouragement, I'm going to just end with some words from Pema Chodron, who says, "Times are difficult globally. Awakening is no longer a luxury or an ideal. It's becoming critical. We do not need to add more depression, more discouragement, or more anger to what's already here. It's becoming essential that we learn how to relate sanely with difficult times. The earth seems to be beseeching us to connect with joy and discover our innermost essence. This is the best way that we can benefit others." So just for the last minute, just to end, I'm going to invite us all into sitting just for one more minute to connect. And I'm going to go ahead and invite you now to place one hand on the heart and one hand on the belly, the eyes closed. Just breathe in. Feel the body breathing. Connecting with your good heart. Connecting with the breath that can help to calm you. And science shows you can offer yourself kindness right through your hands. So see if your heart can sense kindness right through your hands. Maybe tapping into your good heart, tapping into your intention. Maybe even adding a slight smile to the eyes and the lips, and offering yourself kindness. Maybe with the intention of being peace. May I be peace. May I practice being peace. With the eyes still closed, just listening to these words from Judy Hill, who writes, "Wage peace with your breath. Breathe in firemen and rubble. Breathe out whole buildings and flocks of red-winged blackbirds. Breathe in terrorists and breathe out sleeping children and freshly mown fields. Breathe in confusion and breathe out maple trees. Breathe in the fallen and breathe out lifelong friendships intact. Wage peace with your listening, hearing sirens pray loud. Remember your tools, flower seeds, clothespins, clean rivers. Make soup, play music, memorize the words for thank you in three languages. Learn to knit and make a hat. Think of chaos as dancing raspberries. Imagine grief as the out-breath of beauty or the gesture of fish. Swim for the other side. Wage peace. Never has the world seemed so fresh and precious. Have a cup of tea and rejoice. Act as if armistice has already arrived. Celebrate today. Celebrate today.